Back with Russell Banks. His novel, The Sweet Hereafter, has been adapted into a new movie. Russell Banks, was there ever a point in the making of the movie The Sweet Hereafter where you felt like saying to Adam Egoyan, hey, about those changes you're making, this is my story, buddy?
Never quite, although there were a couple of times when I, well, one in particular where I questioned his judgment, and that was his decision to introduce the Pied Piper poem and to have it read both with voiceover and directly in the story. It seemed at the time when he called me up one night and talked to me about it and said, "What do you think?" And I thought, it sounds a little too literary to me.
Well, tell me what he was proposing for our listeners who haven't seen the movie.
To introduce the poem, The Pied Piper, Robert Browning's wonderful long strange poem. Which we usually read as a children's poem, but which in fact has some very dark implications. He wanted to use this as a kind of unifying device and that would run through the entire film, that would in some way provide a kind of ritual reenactment of the story, or imagistic reenactment of the story, and clarify for the viewer somewhat the way at the end of the novel, the demolition derby scene is a ritualization for the community of what's happened. So I thought it was at first just too literary an idea and a device, and as it turned out, I think I was wrong. We talked about it, and I began to think about it, and then when I saw it in the script, because he sent me another draft of the script with it in it, and I saw how he had integrated it into the story. And actually, I later came to, once I saw it in the film, to think it was brilliantly done. It's ironic in a way, because it's the most cinematic aspect of the novel, I think, is the final scene of the demolition derby, and which he had to let go of, because if he had put that into the film, it would have been too much in your face, just too broad. There would be no way to control the tone the way you can in fiction. What he did instead was put something into the film which is extremely literary, but if I had used that in the novel, it would have been, again, too literary, too much in your face. So, but it worked very well, I think, in the film.
The Sweet Hereafter isn't your first experience with film adaptation, with having one of your stories adapted into a film. Have all your experiences been as good as this?
In one other case, a film was made this year. It's just about to come out. Paul Schrader made a film of a novel, Affliction. And it was very similar in many ways, perhaps because both filmmakers, Schrader and Egoyan, are auteur-style type filmmakers, and they were both independently produced. And in both cases, I became friends with the director and involved in the actual production to some degree. So it was very friendly and easy and exciting to me. But in other cases, no, it hasn't been quite that satisfying. I've had novels optioned off and on and watched them fall through the cracks or end up in development purgatory, at least, if not development hell.
I understand you're writing a screenplay yourself now, an adaptation of your novel Continental Drift.
Right, yes. I have written it. I'm now revising it, and I'm working with a couple of people who are partners with me, Willem Dafoe and Linda Reisman, who produced Affliction for Paul Schrader, and Eric Berg, who co-produced that. I'm involved in the filmmaking business now.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I really want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Russell Banks' novel, The Sweet Hereafter, has been adapted into a new movie. We asked jazz critic Kevin Whitehead to review some recent CD box sets. Kevin says jazz fans like the limited edition box sets from the mail order house Mosaic Records because they put out great, if not widely known, music, lavishly packaged in authoritative editions. Now that many of those limited editions have gone out of print, Blue Note has been turning out some scaled-down versions of the same. Kevin says they're worth keeping in mind if you're still shopping for holiday gifts for jazz fans. Thank you.
If you're looking for something lively but not weird to give a jazz fan this season, you might consider the 2-CD set Complete Quartets of Grant Green with Sonny Clark. Green is a splendid guitar player whose spiky attack sparked organ group sessions for a couple of decades. On these early 60s recordings, he teams up with the hard bop pianist Sonny Clark, who, like Green, is not as well known as he should be. With piano behind him, the guitarist solos at length like a horn player. But even when Green plays jazz standards, his sound is deep in the blues. This is Cole Porter's I Concentrate on You. Guitarist Grant Green with Sam Jones on bass and Art Blakey on drums. One reason Green sounds so good is that bright tone he gets, closer to urban blues than the muffled sound many jazz guitarists prefer. It helps explain why even non-jazz fan guitar players like him. On piano, Sonny Clark has the same sort of fluid phrasing and technique and his own heavy blues feel. Another good Blue Note knockoff of an old mosaic box is a 3-CD set of early 50s sides by Stan Getz, the complete Roost recordings. Later, the saxophonist was famed for his ballads. Back then, he was known for playing Whip It Fast with great timing. Be advised, though, the sound quality is not so good. One must-have item for fans of jazz piano or great jazz tunes is the complete Herbie Nichols on Blue Note on 3 CDs. Today, I spare loyal listeners my usual sermon on this neglected giant, enough to note these trio sides with either Max Roach or Art Blakey on drums are Nichols' finest work, and they're usually unavailable, and it's hard to imagine any jazz fan not liking his witty solos or catchy tunes like The Gig. Get this box, and you and yours will be grateful for a lifetime.
Kevin Whitehead is currently living in Amsterdam, where he researched his forthcoming book on Dutch jazz.